It's Wednesday, May 16th, 2018, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, sitting in for Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Ernest Perry and Stacey Wovell. On today's program, it seems everybody leaks in the Trump White House, despite tough talk about those who do. With daily Trump revelations making headlines, print reporters are cashing in with TV networks looking for exclusives. Sports media are salivating over the prospects of new revenue, thanks to a Supreme Court decision this week. And if there's one story that might be able to compete with Trump for the media's attention, it's this weekend's royal wedding. We'll get to those stories in a bit, but first let's talk about the good news, bad news week for Governor Eric Greitens. The good news came Monday as jury selection was grinding on in a St. Louis courtroom. Greitens was accused of invasion of privacy stemming from a photo he was said to have taken without permission of a half-naked woman with whom he was having an affair. Prosecutors never proved there was a photo, and the defense was making headway attacking the circuit attorney's methods. To the surprise of many, prosecutors dropped the charge. The governor called it a great victory, a long time coming.
I am also tremendously, tremendously grateful for the extraordinary courage and patience of family and friends and people of faith who have all recognized that in time comes the truth. We have a great mission before us. And at this time, I'd ask people of goodwill to come together so that all of us can continue to do good together.
The governor did not answer questions from reporters gathered outside the courthouse, but for that matter, neither did the circuit attorney. It doesn't appear the decision has altered the Missouri legislature's course toward possible impeachment, which could pick up steam with a special session that starts Friday. The governor is still charged with a felony for allegedly giving a donor list from a charity he started to his campaign fundraisers, and the House committee investigating Greitens says he may have set up shell companies to hide the identity of one or more donors. Well, the drop charge was at least a bit of vindication for the governor. I'm wondering if you think the news stories you've seen have cast it in that light, though.
I think they initially did, but now you're starting to see the stories sort of change and start talking about these other issues that the legislature is taking up. The other thing that it really pointed out was many of the missteps by the circuit attorney over in St. Louis, and whether or not those charges are going to be refiled with a special prosecutor, if they can find a special prosecutor, if the judge is going to allow a special prosecutor. So now that's all become a muddy situation, at least over in St. Louis.
My big surprise there was that it was such a surprise, and I was watching KOMU's news at the time, and they had a quick reader on it as it broke. And so I went online to try to find more and had trouble. And I think even, you know, the next day, the stories were pretty basic. No one saw this coming. And then it really has now evolved as we're several days past to see more opinion pieces than anything else. Mm-hmm. One in the KC Star I looked at last night talking about maybe this is not great news for Greitens, and said on one case that maybe they can file the sexual assault charge now that they weren't able to file before. So that opinion piece couched it as bad news for Greitens overall.
Well, and even if that charge isn't filed, there's a lot of speculation in the media and elsewhere that the legislature, first of all, doesn't have to have, they don't have to have the same standards for impeachment. And for that matter, he's still charged with taking this donor list from the charity that he started and using it for campaign purposes. That could be probably easier to prove anyway, especially since they hadn't found that photograph.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, you know, now they're talking about these shell corporations, which sort of flies in the face of all this ethics talk that he was talking about during the campaign and the early part of his administration, and if that's proven, that's going to be even more problems for him with the legislature.
Mm-hmm. With the trial delayed or maybe not coming on the invasion of privacy charge, it does put the legislature front and center. They can't wait to see what happens, and you know, if he were acquitted in that, then that might change what they did, or if he were convicted, and so it's all on them now when they start later this week.
I mean, the other thing here is that when you start looking at the coverage of the legislature in the legislative session. It's all been driven by this, and there are a lot of things that they're doing down in Jeff City that just aren't getting the coverage that needs. I mean, the tax cuts that were passed yesterday, and what are the ramifications of that, whether or not that's going to be signed, mm-hmm. whether or not any of these bills that the legislature have passed is going to be signed, including the budget.
Well, and I had a related question, which was, of course, with the special session, there's going to be journalists from all over the state and the country descending on Jefferson City. I just wonder, I don't know if this is a rhetorical question or not, but once the whole cloud over the governor disappears, what's the chance that interest in local news folks covering state government is going to be sustained at anything like that level?
I'm not sure if it will. I don't see that because, I mean, I think the only reason they're covering it now is because of what's happening with the governor. You're starting to see some of that because of the State House Bureau that we've helped build down there with Mark Horvitz and others. So that news is getting out. Whether or not that's going to be sustainable, whether or not it's going to be statewide, whether or not it's going to really start to have an impact on the news that is coming out of Jeff City and the impact that it has on citizens, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it'll go back to business as usual unless we end up with a new governor out of this, and that's a whole new area to cover. Yeah.
Well, the latest spate of leaks from the White House is centered around a comment from a communications staffer that Senator John McCain's opposition to the CIA director nominee didn't matter because he was dying anyway. Rather than apologize, the administration this week has tried to focus attention on the leakers. President Trump tried to have it both ways. He called them traitors and cowards, but he also claimed that the fake news media were massively over-exaggerating the leaks. Well, the president's harsh words, the threats of firing staff members, a ban on cell phones and smartwatches, even a plan to spy on staff through electronic means really hasn't stopped the leakers from leaking. So why is that, Stacey?
Well, I think every White House staffer looks out for number one, first and foremost. And so there are plenty of reasons to leak, to make connections with the press, to leak something ahead of somebody else to get it out there. It is interesting, as the Trump administration tries to stop these leaks, looking back at the Clinton administration, and every administration has leaks, and they didn't have cell phones during the Clinton administration, but his approach, and he was angry at first, but they did end up building sort of a family within the White House that finally slowed that to a trickle. It can be tough for the Trump White House to build a family. That's just not the people he has there.
Yeah, I think part of the problem with the leaks, at least in this administration, is that, as Stacey pointed out, there is no family. I mean, you don't know if the president's going to turn his tweet machine on you tomorrow mm-hmm. or somewhere down the road. So you're sort of building your own case and building your own kind of buffer. And if that means that you need to have some sort of direct line to someone in the news media, you're going to build that out.
There was even a story on Fox News, we have it on our links blog, where Karl Rove is being quoted as saying that Donald Trump is the biggest leaker in his own White House, and so he's setting an example for his staff.
Yeah, we saw the report this week that he is on the phone every night, nearly every night, with Sean Hannity, and so that's a leak system as well. Now, if you're the chief executive, maybe you can't, by definition, leak, but certainly he has his own pipeline to a certain part of the media.
I thought there was another interesting story, Ernest, that we've got on our blog from Axios this week, where a reporter actually called what he called the Trump administration's most prolific leakers and asked them why they did what they did and how they got away with it. And why they did what they did was kind of what Stacey was saying. Either it was a vendetta mm-hmm. against somebody else, or a bill or a policy that didn't go their way, or maybe they just wanted to get on the record what was actually going on. But how they did it was fascinating. They even quoted one staff member in the White House who said he would pick up on the favorite idioms of other staff members and use those in his background quotes to deflect attention from
it. I think what you have is this sort of culture. I mean, it's almost a culture of leaking, and people have their own reasons for why they're doing it. Either it's to further themselves or to further an agenda or just to see whether or not they could actually get away with it. I mean, it's kind of almost a game almost.
And it is so much easier now. We talk about during the Clinton administration or back before that, if you wanted to leak to a reporter, you had to go meet the reporter probably someplace, maybe make a phone call, and now you can do it all sorts of way electronically to get it out there. So it's so much easier now.
You'd think with the White House saying, okay, you've got to put your cell phones and your smartwatches in a locker, and you can go to them kind of like for your lunch in high school, you know, once or twice a day to check them out, that it would be more difficult to communicate electronically at least.
Well, but it depends on who they're actually enforcing that with. Not everyone's going to follow that rule or be asked to follow that rule.
That probably doesn't work in high school either. I'm guessing it's probably about the same. Junior high, maybe.
News organizations may or not be taking a hit to their credibility with the president's constant refrain of fake news media, as we just heard a little bit ago as he was talking about the leakers. But some individual journalists are also profiting from him. BuzzFeed has an interesting story this week. Again, you can read it on our links blog, and it looks into how much money print reporters are making by giving one or the other cable news outlets exclusive access to their Trump scoops. Now, I can understand why the newspaper reporters are willing to appear on CNN or MSNBC. According to this story, they can make $30,000 to $90,000 a year or more, and that's not chump change even if you're an elite journalist in Washington. But what's in it, Stacey, for the cable outlets? Why do they want to pay all this kind of money to have other reporters on their air?
I think it's a win-win. Obviously, for the reporters, the print reporters, they're getting paid, and their work is, not only are they getting that monetary gain, but their work's getting out there to a wider audience that television will deliver. And for a CNN or somebody else, you get to cash in once the work is done. There's a cost to it there, but it's probably far less than it would be maintaining that reporting structure year-round.
I also think what it does is it brings credibility to many of those cable shows that were lacking it, because they were bringing in all of these sort of pundits, and and now you have journalists who are covering stories, who are breaking news, and sometimes that news is coming out on the website just as they're going on the air on, say, MSNBC or CNN. So it does bring some credibility to the shows that they didn't have, at least back during the election.
And at least it feels healthy that there was a competition this week about Uber's changes in its policies with a non-disclosure agreement and doing everything in arbitration. And I saw somebody from the Wall Street Journal, I think, on CBS with that reporting, and then CNN did its own, and they were both claiming to have broken the story and made the change. And so I would much rather see people arguing about who broke an important story like that rather than competing to get yet another pundit on for something.
Well, so we understand why the cable networks would want them. We'd understand why the print reporters want to be there. Why would the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Daily Beast or the employers of these Washington journalists, why would they want to let their reporters take time off from actually reporting so they can be on TV all that
Well, much? I think it builds their brand, and it also breaks their story. I mean, it gives them the ability for their story to reach a wider audience, because they can talk about not only what the information that they're breaking in their print stories or their online stories, but they can also provide some transparency as to how they were able to come up with that information, as long as they aren't, revealing any of their sources, going back to the leaks we were talking about a minute ago.
And it's a way to keep their journalists happy. Let them make the money on the outside and get a little FaceTime for this.
I'm wondering about some journalists who might not be as happy, and that would be the reporters who actually work for CNN or MSNBC or Fox News or whatever. They have to compete for airtime already with the pundits and the political partisans, and now they have to compete with reporters from other news outlets.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that you're going to have some reporters, some broadcast reporters who are pretty upset about that. But for me, as someone who's consuming it, I would rather be listening to journalists who are actually out there doing the work on the ground. And I think it also adds more credibility to the broadcast reporters out there, because, they're working with those same people and saying, yeah, they're getting it right, as opposed to listening to all the opinion right. That you hear all the time.
Yeah, and on cable news, at least, that there's such a push for reporters to be live all the time. And so if you're out on a story, you have to be live every half hour or whatever. They don't have much time to report. It might be a good thing across the board to say you're not on for a few shows, so you can actually go out there and do a little bit of reporting.
True. I think we could probably say the same thing for the print reporters. They have to be pretty much as busy as well. And if they're spending hours of the day on the air talking to anchors and pundits, I'm not sure that gets their job done either. But probably good for the public, at least in some ways. Well, while these reporters are cashing in on Trump, their corporate bosses are looking for readers, ratings, and profits the old-fashioned way by milking a classic trope. Here it is: a young woman meets a troubled young man, saves him from himself, and they live happily ever after. Well, we're talking, of course, about this Saturday's wedding of Prince Harry and American actress Meghan Markle. It's not just the network morning shows, though, of course, they're the biggest promoters of all this, but there's E! And HBO and Lifetime and TNZ and lots of newspapers, too. So why do we in the media care so much about this story?
Well, I don't know if we care that much about the story, and
certainly I'll get on my own care about it.
But I mean, I don't know that they care about it, but they think that there's easy pickings on viewers there. The thing that confuses me, or that I think about, is there should be a niche that you can set aside and say, we're not going to cover this. And you're talking about the morning shows. I like the CBS morning news because it tends to be more news focused than the other two, and even there, well, they haven't had as much. It's come on there now. And I'm like, wouldn't it be good if CBS just said, you know what? You can find that everywhere else, and we're going to spend our time on the news on that. And it seems like in a time when it's easier than ever to move around, that somebody would have done that. But they're chasing the big audience that they think and will be there for this.
And I think that's it. There's an audience for it. There's a big audience for it. And they're going to go after it. And it is somewhat of a dead time right now, sort of a quiet time headed into the summer. So this sort of can fill up some of the airwaves and what's going on. So right now, either you have the royal wedding or you have Greitens. You can have either one of those right. shows.
No, I was going to say, I mean, we've always been fascinated with the royal family, going back decades and decades. But I wonder if maybe we just need something more today to leaven out all the bad news, whether it's Greitens or Trump or whatever it might be, just something that's soft and fun and distracting.
But they're even trying to find some bad news here. The whole controversy involving her father and whether or not he's going to show up. Is he going to walk her down the aisle? If he doesn't, who's going to walk her down the aisle? I mean, it's a story.
And I would argue, if you're a viewer of The Crown, and my wife and I watch The Crown and enjoy that, and so that's a chance to see another messed up family. And we have a interesting administration in Washington, and so I think it's not only something lighter, but it's like, well, even this that looks so perfect from the outside is really fouled up once you get inside of it.
You mentioned the father, and there was some speculation that he wasn't going to come because he was angry over all the media hordes and the deals that were being cut. But there's also some question about whether maybe he just had heart surgery and he can't make the trip. But it was interesting that so far seems to have been the only real controversy the media has been able to dig up on this particular royal wedding so far.
Yeah, we're getting to see Harry's pictures in the Nazi uniform again as they go back. But that goes to your story that she's fixed him. He's not like that anymore.
Well, while we're talking about tried and true ways of making money, getting ratings, getting readers, how about that decision from the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday striking down a federal law that bans sports betting? Now, the ruling doesn't make gambling on games legal right away, but it does give states the option to allow it if they want to. One analysis says that 32 states will join Nevada in making it legal, including here in Missouri. So you can already play the lotto. You can go to your nearest riverboat casino and gamble. Is there really a big new market, you think, Ernest, for sports betting?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a huge market. I mean, you know, we were talking about, you know, FanDuel and all of those. This opens the door for those operations to now go national and not have to deal with whether or not a state is going to ban them or anything like that. So I think it opens that door. But I think the fear right now are the two things. One is how are the major sports going to be able to monetize this? So the NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, they're all trying to figure out how they can sort of get in on this. But the big elephant in the room is the NCAA. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to have to deal with the betting that goes on college football that is already out there under the table. Now it's going to be right out there, right in front, and I'm not sure how they're going to be able to deal with that and still be able to claim this sort of amateurism that has been out there for since its inception.
Mm-hmm. Well, pro sports obviously don't have to worry about that, and although they were opposed for a while to legal gambling on games, it seems like the leagues have come around, Stacey.
Well, I think they realized the writing was on the wall and that they were going to have to join in on this, and their fan base is going to want to bet. I was interested. I think it's the first article you have posted about this approach of how people will get information. And as we talk about the media on the show, this idea about production information that now you won't just look at your sports highlights to enjoy the games of the day. You're going to be deciding how you're going to bet. And we've got an alum who writes about poker and has made a very good living writing about poker, even though that's not a spectator sport in any way that any of these are. But people want that information to learn how to play poker in his case. And so, yeah, I think it's a huge benefit to the media to be able to see viewership go up, readership go up, as people scour to find information to make their bets.
Yeah, I mean, I read an interesting story yesterday when all of this was breaking, was that part of it is that now the people are going to be betting not just on the outcome of the game, but the outcome of individual plays and the outcome of who's actually in the game and all of. So when we start talking about Fantasy League is going to get hurt by this because people are going to start betting on what's actually happening on each individual play.
Yeah, I heard another angle to that, which was since people can now be betting on individual players and plays, even if you have a game that's a snoozer, you know, a blowout, that the networks that are doing the play-by-play might actually benefit from this because you're going to be watching to see whether a particular player, you know, made the line or not for you.
Exactly.
I also wonder about some other ways in which news organizations might cash in on this. So you talked about inside information. Do you think that sports journalists are going to be tapped by these bettors wanting to know whether there's a line? Is it going to really make a difference because we have inside information we can share with?
I'm not sure whether or not that's going to be the case. I think what they're really going to be concerned about is players and teams. This goes back to the whole Black Sox scandal and Pete Rose betting on how many hits he's gonna. That I think that is what's really gonna be an issue is whether or not they're gonna be able to check on players and make sure that they are doing what they're supposed to do and not trying to influence the game in order to deal with the gambling aspect.
Well, and we'll bring it back to leaks, but think of the value of leaks from inside a team where we can say, well, this player's hurt, but he's going to play, and a journalist that has connections that can put out that out there can build a big audience as people are making bets on leaked information.
Yeah. Might we see ESPN or Fox Sports or TNT have a gaming analyst part of their play-by-play teams? Are they going to? Will there be on-air references?
Bring back Jimmy the Greek.
Well, I mean, they're already doing it with the fantasy leagues,
right?
And I could easily see them doing this too. If there's a way to monetize it, ESPN, Fox, and the others will do it.
Are there going to be, let's say, a lot of TV ads for local stations on sports books or state-sponsored gambling? Will there be? We already have the lotto numbers all the time.
And we're seeing the casinos here locally. Isle of Capri advertises, so you could easily see that going into football season in particular, move some of that advertising to you're being able to do some sports betting there once that happens.
But you have to remember, I mean, they've been doing this in Europe forever. So, I mean, I think that we can learn something from what's been happening in Europe forever. So
in Las Vegas.
And Las Vegas. Right. So I'm hoping that, you know, there's some way that we can do this and not just go, you know, to the point where the sports itself is debased and it all becomes about that.
Well, there's already a bill that's been filed in the Missouri legislature this term, probably because of Greitens and other things. They're not going to get around to it. It might be next year. But how long would it legitimately take, you think, before there might be sports betting legalized in Missouri?
Oh, I think it could happen as early as the next legislative session. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, especially if there are tax dollars to be had from that.
And I'm sure the casino could set up a sports book as, you know, the day that passes and assigned, they could get it set up in a few weeks.
Well, and of course, there's the other winner is state government, just like with the lottery. Now they're going to be imposing all kinds of taxes and fees on legalized gambling. So seems like that's a win for state coffers as well.
Voluntary taxation.
Yeah.
Well, we normally try to close the program with what we call a kicker, you know, a lighthearted or bizarre story with a media angle of some sort. But our closer this week is neither of those things. It's kind of complicated and it's a big deal, but it's hiding behind an acronym you've probably never heard of. GDPR stands for the General Data Protection Regulation. What does that mean? Well, it's the European Union's latest digital privacy law, and it goes into effect a week from this Friday. Now, GDPR increases restrictions on what organizations can do with personal data, and it gives European citizens at least more rights to access and control their data that's out there on the internet about them. On the face of that, well, that sounds pretty positive, especially in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal.
Yeah, I mean, it is positive. It's going to be interesting to see how, you know, how Facebook, how Google, and how others are going to be able to deal with this on at least on the other side of the pond, but still, you know, operate as business as usual here in the United States. So it's going to be and it's also going to see how is this going to be regulated. How, I mean, it's easy to put these in, put these kinds of mm-hmm. regulations in place, but how is it actually enforced? And I think that's where we're going to see whether or not it actually works.
Well, some regulators or analysts, I guess I should say, are saying maybe we'll see media companies here block European IP addresses until they figure everything out, that it's hard to figure out and it's not a big part of the market for them. So it would be safer to block those addresses until they figure out exactly what impact it might have on these American companies.
Yeah, so I mean, that's one of the ways, so that's one of the more extreme ways that American advertisers and media companies are trying to figure out what to do. That doesn't seem like that's a long-term strategy. So what do they do to try to meet laws from, you know, outside of the United States that are still important to how they do business?
I mean, I think, well, you know, one of the things that they can do is, I mean, not go to the extreme of blocking, but you can, you know, be a little bit more transparent as to how you're gathering this information. And the kicker to all this, so I think what will help consumers is their ability to be able to access that information to see, you know, here's what's out there about me or and how that is being used. If they can figure out a way to make that happen, I think that will kind of help ease this regulation into everyday life, at least in Europe anyway.
It does tell you something about how globalized the sort of internet regulation mm-hmm. is becoming, because the thing that's the kicker for American companies is that even though they are not located in Europe, if they're gathering data from people who are, then they would supposedly fall under the regulations. And there's been some attempt, at least by companies, Google and others, to fight these European regulations, but sometimes they lose, and they lose pretty big in terms of fines.
Right. It's, you know, again, I keep tying back to other stories, but we saw that with sports betting. All of the big sports betting sites online were out of the country so that they could skirt the laws in the U.S. about that. And now this is the flip side of that. Now the where somebody was able to profit from that. Now the American companies are worried about big losses, big fines on this.
Now I understand, Ernest, why we would want those analytics, want all this data, because especially news media organizations in the U.S. are suffering, as we've been talking about for years now, from a decline in advertising. So they need some way to be able to monetize their digital readers and viewers. So what's wrong, though, with saying, well, while you're doing that, you have to get permission from people to collect their data, and you have to be more transparent about how you use that data?
Well, I think it's a cost thing. I mean, in order to be able to provide that information, you got to have the resources to be able to tell people that, and that increases the cost, which, of course, where's that going to come from? So that hurts your revenue down at the end, and I think that's what a lot of this is about, is that we don't want to incur more costs in trying to be transparent and provide this mm-hmm. information, because that's going to hurt our revenue, hurts our bottom line, and then, you know, we lose our investors. We could have potentially lose investors.
We are seeing consumers get smarter about that, probably most recently because of Facebook, but where we always just click through those terms of service, now people are starting to read that. And I've seen on Facebook a few people I know who seem to have ghosted off of there because they probably don't want to deal with the risk anymore. So smarter consumers are a good thing.
And there was always an assumption that the U.S. government was not in a mood to regulate big media companies and Facebook like others do, but that might be changing mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thanks for spending the last half hour with us. To read more about the topics we talked about today, you can check out our links blog. Find it on the Under the Programs tab, rather, at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Mike McKean. We're taking a few weeks off, but be sure to join us again on June 13th when Ernest Stacy and I will be back with another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.